Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Turkmenistan is heading to another presidential elections. If you listen to the state media, it is the most contested elections in the country's history, with three political parties and number of civic societies putting forward a total of 9 candidates. But the underlying fact is no place for the excitement that there is no doubt about whose name will come out from the February 12 elections, and he is none other than the current president, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, and this will be his third term in office. Taking the presidency might not be a big deal in absence of any genuine political challenge, but given the current socioeconomic situation of the country, there will not be lack of challenge if indeed he takes the office for the third term. So without further ado, let's dive into this. To discuss all this, I'm joined by Dr. Lokhan Cheshchi, who is the author of a book on Turkmenistan's neutrality and chair of the Glasgow University's Central Asia Studies Center. Dr. Loka, welcome to the Majlis.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Dr. Victoria Clement is joining us from Washington, D.C., who is the author of an upcoming book on Turkmenistan and is currently senior fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. She is one of few Westerners who indeed lived in Turkmenistan. Dr. Victoria, welcome to the Majlis.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. Tuning in from Prague is Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Owazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, and Farouk Yusufi, the director of the Turkmen service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Gentlemen, welcome to the Majlis.
Hi.
Thank you.
Very nice to have you. Before to kick off the debate, a gentle reminder that please feel free to amplify, expand, or disagree directly with points other guests are making. Please don't wait for me to prompt your question so that we have a lively debate today. With this, Farouk, let's begin with you. With 9 candidates competing, Turkmen media say an unprecedented democratic process is underway to elect the nation's new leader. Tell us, please, who is the other 8 candidates, the 9th being the President Berdimuhamedov?
Unfortunately, Tahir, you might guess and you know that your question is rhetoric. I mean, no one knows who these 8 competitors are, and neither do I. They say that when they, 3 of them are from 3 so-called political parties in the country, and the rest are just the candidates that were put forward by initiative groups. And we never heard that these initiative groups were running around and collecting signatures. I mean, the election campaign itself was not obvious until 3 or 4 weeks ago, when almost nothing was published in official media, no campaigning on a few TV channels that exist in Turkmenistan. We only knew that President Berdimuhamedov, incumbent, generously said that he doesn't want to use TV time for his campaign, and this time should be equally divided among other candidates. But in reality, we see that state TV is only after President Berdimuhamedov showing him running around the country, meeting with voters, with different groups of people, giving out gifts, and people saying that not only we, our friends and families will vote for you. And this is, as activists are pointing out, a clear violation of the country's election laws. Uh-huh. I mean, there is no, maybe by Turkmen official standards, this is one of the most competitive elections in the country's history, but it's nothing near to decent election campaign that we could observe in neighboring Kyrgyzstan, or even in Uzbekistan. There was some sort of show off of election campaigning.
Yeah. We will get to the comparison between Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. Bruce, you had a few days ago a tragic, funny story on the process that's going on in Turkmenistan these days. What do you know about the background of other 8 people?
You know, I have to go with Farouk here. I mean, really, these guys just came out of nowhere. No one ever heard of these people before. You know, I see their names on the list and what they do. But, you know, with the guy that's in charge of the state food procurement and processing, and, you know, and the head of the Saidi refinery, who also happens to be a member of parliament. And at this point, I should point out that the Said refinery is one of two in Turkmenistan, and it's by far the smallest one of the two. So it's nothing, you know. I mean, it's funny to hear people, you know, that they keep saying this is supposed to be the most competitive election in Turkmenistan's history, but you know, we're playing fast and loose with the meaning of the word competitive. As far as there being more candidates competing in this election, yeah, sure. Do any of these people have even a remote chance? I'll even say a remote chance of even getting 1% of the vote, and I would say no. So it's not really competitive. It's, you know, it's the typical Turkmen show. It's supposed to give people the idea that there is a democratic process underway for the election of president. But, you know, eight unknown people with no hope in the world of getting, you know, more than a couple thousand votes each, probably. Yeah. You know, there's nothing there.
I've been looking into your story, Bruce. Some of the candidates put forward by the so-called opposition political parties in Turkmenistan, they are the members of provincial councils from Mari, from, I don't know, some other regions, even not a member of central leadership. Dr. Luka, what is striking in this list is that the other candidates, as I just mentioned, do not have even a prominent position in their own parties, let alone on the national political stage of the country. I know, and they know, that their participation is just a formality, but is it a deliberate message of some sort on their behalf? How to understand this?
Look, I've tried to work out, not this time, but in the first Behdi Muhammadov election, I tried to work out the criteria behind the selection of these people, and I've tried to look into geographical distribution, the combination of government agencies and maybe more local administration, energy sector, agriculture, but I couldn't really come up with any conclusion with that. I did the same 5 years ago, and it seemed to me just a random selection of people. This time, although they say it's the most competitive, I didn't bother. So it seemed to me that this multi-candidate, if you want, nature or the election, is the perfect mirror of the multi-party, if you want, nature or the election. Totally irrelevant. It's a charade. So Bruce is right. This is to give maybe the internal population the illusion that there is some sort of democracy exercise going on. Or maybe just to attract some, I don't know, some kind of positive comment from the international community. But I can no longer make sense of why they keep doing this and they keep sort of increasing the numbers. I wouldn't really talk about this election just by looking at the process. I think, and I wrote this, that the context is much more interesting. The level of denial that this regime has reached, in which having totally fictitious election at a time of such economic crisis, is what really should get our attention, I think.
I know Washington is far away from this, Victoria. What you have been getting from Turkmenistan in terms of the process which is taking place these days?
Well, I think that our speakers are right to point out that this is not a democratic process, that there are reasons why the government of Turkmenistan is holding this, what it's calling an election, and that it gains benefits, especially domestic benefits. But I do think that it's worth pointing out that the election process in and of itself is an important stage in a country's path. You know, for it to progress in any way, this kind of activity needs to be normalized and routinized. So the process is, I think, a little bit more interesting than we're illustrating here. I'd also say that while the eight candidates that are running against President Behdi Muhammadov might be unknown to the outside world, I do believe that they have regional recognition. Huh. Deputy head of the Mari Wilayet, deputy head of the Dashauz Wilayet, chairman of the Mari Wilayet. These are people who are known locally.
But I mean, their prominence would be, as you pointed out, very very localized. I mean, the deputy hakim of a vilayat or a region would be only known to in his own region. And from what I hear from our colleagues there, they say no one knows anyone among these eight people, and no one is even interested in reading those posters that are put on the streets. This is to give some sort of weight to the president that he will win like 97% or 98% of the votes in a very competitive election. This is to give him some weight, to give him some importance, I think.
Berdimuhamedov was going here and there meeting people. So what he has been saying, which we can regard as an election promise?
All his promises. We heard this kind of promises before in the past elections, and all of his promises are very ambitious. He says that he will lead the country into the rank of the most industrialized countries in the world. He says he promises that all of the people will flourish in the next 5 to 10 years, and he promises that by 2030 these candidates in Central Asian region, they always promise something by 2030 or by 2040. I mean, this is a sham, to put it simply.
I would point out too that when he was playing his guitar at that gas and chemical complex in Akhol Vilayat, he did promise he would have a bunch of new songs ready for Women's Day. So
earlier you were talking about, Bruce, you can also take this question if you wish, that some comparison between the recent election in Uzbekistan and the ongoing process in Turkmenistan. What's the matching elements, and what are striking differences?
Farouk, if you want to start, I'll pick up after you.
The situation in Uzbekistan was completely different. I mean, they had the unexpected elections because the president Karimov died, and in Uzbekistan, the appointed interim president started playing liberal. And we have to yet see what how he will carry his promises. But at this, so far, we see that European Bank of Development and Reconstruction promised to renew the cooperation with the country and bring in some investment. And there were some other major investors that are nodding optimistically. And in the presidential elections, we saw that the state TV was showing all the rest competitors as they were meeting with people, as they were, to a certain degree, reading out or stating their programs. Whereas in Turkmenistan, yes, we do see limited footage of the other candidates, but without their voices. Only the presenters saying that this candidate met with people in this district of this region, and they only show them for a few seconds. Whereas when Berdimuhamedov is driving around in his pickup truck, driving to the shepherds in Akhol region, they show how he's driving for 10 or 15 minutes, how he's driving, how he's tough, lonely ranger in the deserts. He's being shown as a real hero, Superman.
Well, Farouk, just to follow up, Bruce, I will come back to you. We do not expect a huge crowd of people coming in support of their candidates with slogans, etc. But did people even come to Berdimuhamedov's own rallies? Like, did you see a huge crowd waiting and welcoming him?
There were no rallies. There were meetings. There were organized meetings in the closed rooms. Like, he would come to a room. Only the outside meeting was with the shepherds in one of the districts in Akhol region, where he met with them outside a yurt, a Turkmen yurt, and there were maybe a few dozens of people clapping to him and saying Arkadağa Şuhrat, which means praise to our Arkadağ or protector.
Okay, if you are trying to show this as a kind of a contested election with 9 candidates and all this stuff and some promises, but even there is no kind of a fact rallies taking place to show that this process really taking place, what's the message behind that?
Bruce, do you want to say something?
Yeah, I suppose I'll get in here real quick and let our other guests go into this too. One that we know these things are heavily scripted from the start. That is one thing that compares very, very much Uzbek presidential elections and this latest campaign for Turkmen presidential elections. These spots are picked. The population, local officials are informed in advance that this is happening. They pick a certain amount of people that they're going to bring out when the cameras are rolling. They meet with the presidential candidate, the favorite in Mirziyoyev's case, the incumbent in Turkmenistan's case, and so everything is pretty much by the numbers. They know in advance how this is going to go, how many minutes it's going to take, all this kind of stuff. So, okay, Berdi Mukhamedov said he wasn't going to do a huge campaigning or something like that. If you wanted to ask my opinion of why they don't have any big rallies or anything, is one, the people don't have any real reason to be enthused by this president at all. I know we're going to talk about the socioeconomic situation soon, and Luca wrote a great paper on this today, but the situation is bad in Turkmenistan. Why would you want to come out, do a fake show of support for this candidate? And from Berdi Mukhamedov's side and his security side, they're probably not too sure that someone won't throw something at him, because, he's really running the country into the ground. I just can't imagine. I would be worried if I was in his shoes and had to address a crowd of 20 or 30,000 people that someone might just be fed up and throw a brick at me or something.
Just if I can just jump in for a second, Mohammed, sure. You cannot have 5 years of extreme authoritarianism and then have a couple of weeks of democracy. It doesn't work like that. So in that sense, going around the country is the kind of show that they have to put up to signal some sort of support, even though this is very fictional and in fact reduced. But it seems to me that the most interesting part of the campaign is the fact that they're talking about a fantasy that is going on only in the mind of the regime and the propaganda. So in that sense, these are all components of the same film play. We got the main lead, the main hero, and then you got the other eight candidates and, regional importance, of course, yes, but no one does have the kind of national recognition that Mukhamedov enjoys. And then you have this going around the country, giving presents to the people. It has become so entrenched. It's actually bizarre. Yeah. Bizarre. And I really wonder why they bother at all at this stage. And it is incredible that after 10 years, we keep talking about this. If we look at elections at sort of benchmarks or checkpoints of what the regime has done, we could see that the performance has really deteriorated in the face of of this kind of periodic coronation that we're seeing. So I am actually more puzzled than I was before about this coming vote.
If I may add to this, for Turkmenistan, it's sort of a ritual. And to add to Bruce's point about the security, in the past 2 weeks, I received three different reports about alleged protests in different regions of the country. One I received last night about a protest in Balkan. Of course, we cannot. It's very difficult to verify those reports and to check and confirm it independently. That's why we are not reporting. And even if those reports that were sent to me are false, I mean, the fact that there is such a rumor that protest is possible in Turkmenistan is an indication of there is some discontent among the public.
No, yeah.
One thing I would just like to add very quickly is that Bruce is right. This is all heavily scripted, and the people who participate in these meetings with the candidates are hand selected by the government. But I think the part of the reason why the government bothers to do this is so that it can have a veneer of support. It wants to be able to claim a popular mandate. Berdi Mukhamedov wants those inflated numbers, that inflated victory, so that he can say he's been elected.
Yeah, this is such a tragically funny stuff. But at the end, we all know whose name will come out from the ballot boxes as a winner. But will his third term presidency be any different? Let's do some brainstorming on that shortly. We'll be right back. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, Arif Yaril's Central Asia podcast. We are discussing Turkmenistan's upcoming presidential elections. Joining the debate are from Glasgow, UK, Dr. Lukan Cesci, the author of a book on Turkmenistan's neutrality. From Washington, Dr. Victoria Clement is joining us, who's the senior fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Tuning in from Prague is Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Ovozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, and Farokh Yusufi, the director of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Turkmenistan service. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, it has been a difficult second term with lots of challenges. First and foremost, economic difficulties and its impact on people. Let's recall some of the highlights of his second term. Let's start with you, Bruce.
Oh, highlights or lowlights? Well, let's start out with the fact that Turkmenistan's economy is run on pretty much based on gas exports, and it lost Russia as a customer last year. The ongoing dispute with Iran means that they're not making any money off of that right now. Huh. And that leaves China as their only customer. We know that China's loaned them a lot of money, and some of the gas that goes to China is considered repayment of the loans that they've given to Turkmenistan. And at this point, I will say that Line D, which is supposed to be the big line of the Central Asia China gas pipeline, is horribly behind schedule at the moment. We talked to people in Kyrgyzstan who said no one's even brought it up since December 2015. That was the key one for Turkmenistan, because that was going to be 30 billion cubic meters of gas, which was probably all coming from the Turkmen fields to China. It's at least 5 or 6 years off schedule now. And that means that with the existing pipelines they got there, they only got 55 billion cubic meters of capacity. 10 billion cubic meters of that goes to Kazakh gas, 10 billion goes to Uzbek gas, which leaves 35 billion cubic meters for Turkmen gas, and that's almost as much as they pumped this last year. So revenues are not going to go up at all, practically, from this point and for the next, pretty much the better part of the next decade. So they're out there. GDP growth was about 14% on the eve of the election in 2012. It's down to about 5%, somewhere between 5 and 6%, so it dropped almost 10% in this last term. We know there's been food shortages in the country. You know, I mean, it just kind of runs the whole, anything you can look at in society, you know, subsidies for utilities, water and things like that, about to be taken away from the people because they can't afford to give it to them for free like they have for all these years. Security problem on the Afghan border, much worse. 2012, no problem at all. Now, we don't know exactly, but we do know that there's a problem, and it has spilled over into Turkmenistan more than once. So there is no highlight to point to.
Okay, Dr. Luka, how did he cope with them, with these challenges that Bruce mentioned?
Look, to be fair, these shocks were mostly external. I mean, the Iran withdrawal was, you know, more of a Turkmen sort of problem. But the problem with the Afghans at the border and the troublesome relationship with Gazprom were actually sort of not all his fault. So it seemed to me that rather than giving him the sort of the regime the fault for everything that happened, I could detect a very sort of short-term reaction policy. So when they saw that the relationship with Gazprom was deteriorating, rather than just looking for potential partner, they kept doing the same, which means engaging in this long negotiation for 30, 40 BCM pipelines rather than focusing on smaller deliveries, 7 or 8, which may actually have the economy go. And when it comes to Afghanistan, I did a really at the border. I mean, I don't see that discussed very much in any kind of official media, which seems to me that they're doing the same thing, which is just ignoring at least sort of in a sort of outward level, what's going on. They may be worried, they are worried, but we haven't seen any sort of visible reaction about that policy. For me, the biggest failure that we've seen in the last 10 years is the realization that the economy needed change and nothing has been done. Bruce made sort of, you know, like all these numbers about how good was in 2012 and how good it is now. We can even go back to his first election in 2007. I would be very surprised if we can see any kind of substantive change in the way in which the economy is led, is articulated, mm-hmm. and production is structured across Turkmenistan.
Mm-hmm.
The economy has been unchanged, and this is no longer sustainable at a time in which you are trading gas at half the price that you were five years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that will go down in history as the regime's fault.
Dr. Victoria, and yes, talking about his second term, we should also not forget that he had a first term. So was he any better in dealing with the challenges that Dr. Lucan Bruce mentioned in his second term compared to his first term? Is he getting better any in dealing with leadership challenges that he faced or his country faced?
You know, he has challenges beyond the economic, so that there are questions of social and cultural issues. And I don't think we can say that things are getting better. But it is worth pointing out, I think, that there were some improvements since President Niyazov's time to President Berdimuhamedov. I mean, there's been greater use of the internet, improvement of the health sector, a recovery from the former president's policies in education, and some liberalizing reforms related to small and medium enterprises. And I know that this isn't enough because we're still missing an independent media. They still don't have real political pluralism. There's still a lack of freedom of association. So there are real social and cultural the pressing issues that need to be dealt with. Berdimuhamedov started talking about reform and undertook some. He needs to undertake more.
Farouk, talking about his second term, we cannot avoid discussing about the crackdown against some of the few remaining independent journalists in the country. How have been your reporters coping with the intensified pressure?
As you know, last year, one of our reporters, Safar Mehmet Nepeskuli, was jailed, and we still don't know about his fate. The previous year, 2015, Safar Mehmet was jailed. And last year, beginning September, we started feeling more pressure when they called our correspondents for questioning, and then Sultan Achilova, 67-year-old reporter, was attacked three times in 1 month. Finally, on December 3rd, our correspondent was arrested. Since then, we haven't heard anything from him about him, except for that we could confirm that he was tortured heavily. And these signs, the attack and crackdown on the civil society and the journalists, is some sort of indication that the regime is getting nervous and making nervous moves. And the situation is probably, for the Turkmen person listening in Turkmenistan, that could sound exaggeration because they get used to this kind of situation. But from what we see from Prague, sitting in Prague, the situation is worsening, and there are new restrictions every day. For example, they're restricting withdrawal of money from the banking cards. We reported about that yesterday. Last week, we reported about restriction of the money transfers to the students studying abroad, which means that a lot of students have to quit their studies abroad because they cannot get money from their families in Turkmenistan. So this kind of restrictions immediately affecting ordinary Turkmens, we're seeing new and new every day. There is, I don't know how the things will change, because as other participants of the discussions pointed out, the credibility of the country or the stability of the country was based on the presumption that the prices for the energy would stay high and everything would be okay in the country's economy. But it turned out to be not true.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, if he elected for the third term, what are some of the main and immediate challenges that he will inherit from himself?
That's a good way to put it. You know, I mean, they're going to have to do something about their currency policy. There's just no doubt about it. It is absolutely contradictory to good trade practices. I know that they don't want to have a drastic devaluation, which will certainly happen if they decide to let their money, the manat, float, but they're going to have to do it. They can't trade with this artificial rate that they keep doing. Now, of course, they would have seen what happened in Kazakhstan last year, you know, when at the end of 2015, Kazakhstan decided to let the rate float. And then in early first half of 2016, we saw protests that we, you know, the likes of which we hadn't seen in 20 years. This has got to be scaring some of the Turkmen officials. But this is inevitable. They cannot leave the manat at the rate that it is. It's strangling their ability to trade and attract foreign investment, bring new foreign partners into projects that they're doing. So that's one thing that's got to be confronted immediately. They have also got to get rid of these false ideas that these other pipelines that they're trying to get through, TAPI, one, Trans-Caspian, another, are going to happen anytime soon. They keep billing this as like savior projects for the country. If we can just hold on for a couple more years, we'll have these things built and then it'll be going. You know, time is going to run out on these promises pretty soon. TAPI's supposed to be up in 2019, according to Berdy Muhammedov and his crew, and it's not even close. You know, they have supposedly some sections laid in Turkmenistan, and Pakistan reported that it was starting to do some there. But the key link here is, besides Balochistan and southern Pakistan, is Afghanistan, where nothing is being done at all at the moment toward building TAPI. So they're going to have to give up on that and come up with some other savior projects that are more realistic to try to keep people waiting with some hope for a little while longer. But you know, like I said, and to be fair, last comment, you know, I mean, people have already mentioned in this thing that a lot of the stuff that's happening to Turkmenistan is not Berdy Muhammedov's fault. That's true. A lot of external factors have worked against Turkmenistan in the last 2 years, 3 years, and they are suffering from that. But the government's reaction to these problems has been denial or just flat out lying about the severity of the problem. And it's not helping anything.
Dr. Luka, challenges are accumulating from some time already. And what should he do differently, indeed, if he becomes president for the third term, to be able to deal with these challenges that we are discussing today?
Well, we cannot expect that change happens just when things are immediately wrong. There will have to be a point in which someone in Ashgabat start telling the president that change needs to come, otherwise the whole house just folds. And I think, for me, the very first thing that they will have to do, I mean, this goes beyond, of course, improvement in human rights, social rights, that goes beyond, you know, without saying. But I think that the first thing that they will have to do, they will have to start revising the energy policy. They will have to get to a point in which some external partner must be allowed to invest in onshore gas fields. So if you bring that up, you start production going, you get more money coming through, and you have an easier capacity to export. That could also bring jobs in the short terms. We know that there have been a lot of sort of layoffs in Turkmengas Troy, in the different regional departments. So that could sort of alleviate a little bit the pressure on the people. And then, so once you open up the energy sector and having a more realistic pipeline policy, those would be the two most immediate challenges for me. Also because I don't think that any other sector is develop. So rather than saying we will go petrochemicals or we'll keep exporting electricity to Afghanistan, I think that what they should realistically do is do change in the things that they have, which is gas, and then take it from there. But I don't have a crystal ball, of course, and we don't make predictions, but I struggle to see this kind of regime going on for 5 more years in this way, you know, with the only one customer, with a very repressive social policy, with a very opaque rights policy, with no participation. I can't see things going on for 5 years more. Even if I agree with, you know, Central Asia got a lot of sort of the resilience, the population are resilient. I cannot see this kind of sort of trend going on in the same direction for 5 years. Change will have to come. So if I were an advisor, I would tell him that he will have to start changing before things change him in that sense.
Unfortunately, we have to conclude the discussion. The final point, Dr. Victoria, Dr. Luka just made an interesting point. If you would be advisor of the President Berdy Muhammedov in his term, what would be your advice that he should start doing immediately?
I think that Luka listed some important things. We can't expect anything more than incremental reform, if any. And those political rights and civil liberties are something that need to be focused on.
Okay, great stuff. Thank you very much, Dr. Victoria Clement, Woodrow Wilson Center Fellow, also an author of upcoming book on Turkmenistan, Dr. Lukan Cesci, Chair of the Glasgow University's Central Asian Studies, Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia Blog, Kishlak Owazi, and Farouk Yusufi, Director of the Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Turkmen Service. Thank you very much for your time and thoughts, ladies and gentlemen, today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.